We now continue with a plenary session entitled Pillars of My Faith.
All my life, in no time at all, I found myself on the executive committee, right? Because I knew how to run a meeting, you know, and so on. And so did the other Mormon on the board. This organization was being run by five people, including two Mormons. Two of the three men were Mormons. And two women, Mary Calderon and the gynecologist lady whose name I forget momentarily. I was going around the world doing good, I thought, in this way. And at the same time, I was district president of the Central Pennsylvania District of the Church, shoring up the saints, traveling every Sunday over any kind of weather, you know, training branch presidents and trying to get people not to vote out the branch presidents they have. We came into a branch conference one time and sustained the officers, and they voted them out. It was didn't happen everywhere. Didn't do anything wrong. They just thought it was time for change, you know. I was trying to do the Lord's work, and we had good, you know, given the comparison groups in the mission field, we had the best, the most building sites, and we had the highest home teaching, the most auxiliaries organized, and I was doing a good job, and I was loving it, you know. I loved those people. They taught me a lot of the things about the gospel that I needed to learn. The Lord taught me through that service. And I was watching conference one day. Now, mind you, I knew that there were people who thought that sex education was terrible. In fact, the John Birch Society, forgive me if any of you want to make the sign to ward off evil here. made a little film thing called The Rape of Innocence, which had a picture of the Savior, glass window, and the little children around him. The organ music swelled, and then it said, if any shall offend one of these little ones, it were better than a millstone be hung around the neck, they'd be drowned, and then you'd see them, and then came Mary Calderon's picture, and Bill Janae's picture, and my picture, each with a hammer and sickle imposed on our faces, and we referred to as comrade, comrade, and comrade, you know. But I was on the whole flattered that they would think that I was that good, and it didn't bother me too much. But at General Conference, which I was watching in my living with my family, a talk was given by Elder Dyer on which he named Secus and said that it was led by evil and conspiring men seeking to lead the youth of the world astray. I mean, you could have hit me with an axe. I thought I was a good man doing good work. My daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, flounced out of the room. She said, I don't watch General Conference to hear my father, you know, vilified. Well, all I could think of was that somehow the brethren had got hold of some of this, I can even think of ways this might have happened, some of this literature. I was sure it was a misunderstanding, and that if I could get to the brethren and let them understand what I knew to be true, that they wouldn't feel that way about it. So I wrote to Brother Dyer. Well, before that, I've got to tell you one other short story. I promised I was going to quit by now, but I've got to finish this story. 3 weeks before that had happened, I got a letter from an anguished colleague of mine, a Latter-day Saint who was active in the church and a church leader at a local level, who had got in a controversy over the issue of nudism. Not my thing. For obvious reasons, probably. all nudists have hair on their chest. I have three hairs all around this left nipple, and that's it. Anyway, that was this morning's census, anyway. He was involved in nudism, and so he talked it over with the state president, and the state president had taken a liberated view about it and said that was up to him. But he wrote an article in the paper that some of the brethren saw, and so the brethren wrote him a letter and said, you're going to have to choose between whether you're going to be an advocate of nudism or whether you're going to be a leader in the church. And he was agonizing over this, wanted my advice. And now it's easy to give, cheap to give advice when you're not in the situation. I mean, his cause did not turn me on. But his situation, I thought, was one that I said to myself, well, I said to him, I wrote back a letter very thoughtfully. I prayed about it. I said, listen, you know, I'm not in your situation. But if I were, I tried to put myself in your situation. I tried to think, what if, for example, the church came out against sex education? What I would do. And as best I can say what I would do, I would only have two choices. One, I would decide that after all, the brethren had been called by the Lord to guide the church and to call members back when they get off the path through their own step-by-step, wandering. And I would be grateful that the brethren were inspired to warn me when I needed to. Or, two, I would conclude, as you seem to feel, that the brethren are subject to their own generational and cultural backgrounds and experiences, what you call the Wasatch mentality. But nevertheless, I have sustained them. I have promised to sustain them. And I would make whatever Abrahamic sacrifice was required of me, because I cannot think of a third alternative that I would entertain. He did not take my advice, but I went right from the conference address and looked up that letter that I'd written him. I knew the Lord had prepared me, that at a time when it wasn't me, I was able to answer my own question. I haven't got the time to tell you about what transpired, except that I was released as district president, and I wish that the missionaries who drove the mission president had not told me that a general authority told him, well, I'll tell you this, I would never have a man like that presiding in my mission for 5 minutes. I wish I hadn't known that. Because I was a home teacher for the next 2.5 years. And I loved that district. There were projects I wanted to finish. There were people that I had not finished helping. There were things I wanted to do, and the new man would either do them or he wouldn't do them. And I was just cut off. I felt for years I was blackballed. No one was more surprised than I when I finally was made a state president. No one. It was Elder Packer, too. I have to quit, although I'm not through. But I think my life experiences have taught me this. I love intellectual things. I love questioning and reading. I subscribe to all the journals and, read them all. That's my avocation. That's my vocation. That's what I make my life livelihood by, is researching and questing. But my spiritual faith, that's grounded in a different order of magnitude of experience. It's based on 1,000 experiences with the spirit of love and of concern, of teaching. I've been taught not always kindly by the Lord, but always for my own. Well, that's not true. Always kindly, but not always gently. By the Lord. I've been taught the things that I need to know, and I've felt his hand. I know his person. He's taught me what kind of being he is, and I know that. And I know further that when I go through the veil, I will not be examined on my intellectual attainments. That is my faith.
I need to say as I begin that this essay began as a short essay in Exponent 2. And I forewarn you, because the first couple of pages, the people in the audience who read Exponent 2, it may sound familiar, but I want to reassure you that you'll get a little bit more for your money tonight, that there's a little bit more than was in the original essay. It begins with an Emily Dickinson poem that I first heard 25 or 26 years ago in an American literature class at the University of Utah. And I can see myself sitting there in that class and remember exactly what I thought. It was a wonderful teacher, but the rumor was that this teacher had once been a Mormon and was inactive or lapsed in some way. And a little kind of electric message came to me as he was reading that poem, and I asked myself, oh, is that how it feels like to lose faith? You probably remember the poem. It dropped so low in my regard, I heard it hit the ground and go to pieces on the stones at bottom of my mind. Yet blame the fate that flung it, less than I denounced myself for entertaining plated wares upon my silver shelf. Since then, I have lost faith in many things. New York Times book reviews, Olympia typewriters, texturized vegetable protein, and I could go on. I've also, like many of you here, had to question some of my deepest religious beliefs. I think I've always been a skeptical person. I can remember raising my arm in my beehive class in the Sugar City ward in Idaho and telling my teacher that no matter what she said, I did not believe that polygamy was sent by God. I think maybe that kind of behavior had something to do with another experience I had. We had an MIA gypsy party, and one of the teachers told fortunes, and she traced the lines on my hand, and she told me that my headline was longer and better developed than my heart line. For a while, I really worried about that. As I've grown older, I've become much less fearful of those stones at the bottom of my mind. In fact, I've learned that, for me at least, a willingness to admit disbelief is often an important and essential prerequisite to spiritual growth. I think all of us meet challenges to our faith at various times, although I suspect there are people who have foam rubber rather than stones at the bottom of their mind, and things just kind of bounce off. And I'm interested in those people, and I'm intrigued by them. But at least for me, there are times when I really have felt shattering. I find the Emily Dickinson poem helpful. Some things fall off our shelf because they didn't belong there in the first place. They were plated wares rather than genuine silver. Now, when I first heard that poem, I didn't really understand it because the only plated wares I know anything about were Oneida or William Rogers, and although they weren't sterling, they hardly fell to pieces when they fell on the floor. Then I learned about lusterware, which was the most popular plated wares of Emily Dickinson's time. In the late 18th century, British manufacturers developed a technique for decorating ceramics with a gold or platinum film. In one variety, a platinum luster was applied to the entire surface, creating something that was called poor man's silver. It was shiny, inexpensive, easy to get, but it was also fragile, as breakable as any other piece of pottery or china, and only a very gullible or very inexperienced person would mistake it for true silver. I think most of us can recognize some lusterware in our own minds. A lusterware Joseph Smith, for example, is unfailingly young, handsome, and spiritually radiant. He's unschooled, but never superstitious. Persecuted, but never vengeful. Human, but never mistaken. A lusterware image fulfills our need for an ideal without demanding a great deal from us, and I could go down a list of the lusterware in my own life. A number of years ago, I read an interesting letter from a woman. She said that she used to think of the church as 100% true, but now she had discovered to her great sorrow that the church was 10% human and only 90% divine. Now, I've already said I was a skeptic, and when I read that letter, I remember wanting to sit down immediately and write her a letter and say, if you can find any earthly institution that's 10% divine, hang on to it with all your heart. I think 10% may be too high an estimate. Jesus spoke of grains of salt and bits of leaven, and he told his disciples that the kingdom of heaven is likened to a treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath and buyeth that field. And I'm intrigued with that image. You buy the whole field for what is hidden in it. Thus a small speck of divinity, the salt in the earth, the leaven in the lump of dough, the treasure hidden in the field, gives value and life to the whole. Now, the question, I guess, is where in this earthly institution, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, do we go to find the leaven? To the bishop? To the prophet? To the lesson manuals? Do we find it in Relief Society? In sacrament meeting? And if we fail to discover it in any of these places, do we decide the whole lump is worthless? Well, I think Jesus' answer was clear. The leaven must be found in one's own heart, or not at all. The kingdom of God is within you. Many years ago, I was complaining to my bishop, and he countered with a statement that I've never forgotten. He said, "The church is a good place to practice the Christian virtues of forgiveness, mercy, and love unfeigned." And that startled me. He didn't say the church was a place to find those virtues. He said the church was a place that required those virtues. I guess I had always thought of the church as kind of a nice warm cushion, a source of warmth and comfort when things got tough, and they hadn't ever gotten very tough for me in my life. And it really hadn't occurred to me that the church could make things tough. Eliza R. Snow expressed it in this way in a hymn that for some reason seems to be missing from the new hymn book. "Think not when you gather to Zion, your troubles and trials are through, that nothing but comfort and pleasure are waiting in Zion for you. No, no, 'tis designed as a furnace, all substance, all textures to try, to burn all the wood, hay, and stubble, the gold from the dross purify." Maybe the hymn deserved to be left out of the new hymn book, because I think if you listen to the third stanza, you realize that the author, like more than one Relief Society president before her, had made too many welfare visits and had listened to too many sad stories. Her charity failing, she told the complainers in her ward to shape up and solve their own problems. "Think not when you gather to Zion. The saints here have nothing to do but to look to your personal welfare and always be comforting you." In the church, as in our own families, as Jean England has taught us, we have both the worst and the best of times. A young missionary on a lonely bus ride somewhere in Bolivia thinks he is equal to what lies ahead. He can endure strange food, hard work, and a confusing dialect. But nothing in the mission training center has prepared him for a filthy apartment, for a cynical first companion, and for a parakeet that lives with all its droppings under the other man's bed. A young bride, ready to enter the temple, feels herself spiritually prepared. She's chosen a simple white gown, and she's avoided all the frippery of the world. She's discussed the covenants with her stake president. She believes she understands them. Yet sitting in the endowment room, in ritual clothing no one thought to show to her, saying words she does not understand, she turns to her mother in dismay and says, "Am I supposed to enjoy this?" An elders' quorum president, pleased that his firm has won the contract for the ward remodeling project, prepares for the hard work ahead. He knows the job will be demanding. He expects some tension between his responsibilities as a project manager and his commitment to the church, and he's ready to consecrate his time and talents for the upbuilding of the kingdom. What he doesn't expect is the anger and the humiliation that follow a year-long encounter with the church bureaucracy. "I wonder how far up this goes," he says, and thinks of leaving the church. A middle-aged woman reads deeply in the scripture, sharing her insights with friends individually and in a small study group. She feels secure in her quest for greater light and truth until she begins to examine certain troubling episodes in church history. The discrepancy between the official accounts and the new evidence upsets her. Has she been lied to? And if on one issue, why not many? But that isn't the really serious problem. The problem for her is that when she confides these doubts to her friends, her good friends, who have been in her study group, she feels them back away. "And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock." What rock can secure us against such storms? Occasionally, some gentle soul, puzzled by my outspoken ways, will say to me, "What keeps you in the church?" And I often answer, "My skepticism." I've noticed over the years that some of us with doubts sometimes wear better than those who consider themselves true believers. But of course, I think that answer is inadequate. I don't stay in the church. I've never contemplated leaving the church. I love the church, and I stay in it, not because of what I don't know, but because of what I do. The church I believe in is not an ascending hierarchy of the holy. It is millions of ordinary people calling one another brother and sister and trying to make it true. Not so long ago, I had one of those terrible, wonderful experiences that I've been talking about, and the details aren't important, except that it was a classic Liahona iron rod confrontation between me and my bishop, and I ended up in the bishop's office shaking, really. It was a very difficult experience. But after some sleepless nights and prayer and anguish, I went back to the bishop. And what followed was for me a small miracle. I told him, I really opened my heart to this man, and he listened. And the only way I can account for it, I really think that it was a question of the Spirit of Christ being present in the room. Our opinions didn't change, but our attitudes toward each other did. As I told a friend afterward, if we hadn't been Mormons, we would have embraced. There are many small experiences that we could talk about and that I've mentioned in my essay, and I really won't go into all of those. I do want to say that as I study the scriptures, and that's been a very important thing for me, I love the scriptures. But one of the things I've learned from the scriptures, that very few of the problems that worry me are new. I wonder how men, presumably in tune with the divine, can be so complacent and so self-righteous in their dealings with women. And then I read Luke's account of the visit of the angel to the women at the tomb on the first day of the week. And I read that Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women who were with them went and told of their experience to the apostles. And their words seemed as idle tales, and they believed them not. I wonder how a church devoted to eternal values can invest so much energy in issues that strike me as unimportant. And then I read the 19th chapter of Leviticus and find the second greatest commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, side by side with a sober command that neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon thee. Seems to me that in every dispensation there has been lusterware and silver in ours and in the past. What seems to me important is that the Spirit of Christ continues to touch and to redeem our lives. I love Joseph Smith's ecstatic recital in Doctrine and Covenants 128. It's one of my favorite scriptures. Now, what do we hear in the gospel which we have received? A voice of gladness, a voice of mercy from heaven, a voice of truth out of the earth, and then this wonderful recital of place names, which is so marvelous. A voice of the Lord in the wilderness of Fayette, Seneca County. The voice of Michael on the banks of the Susquehanna. The voice of Peter, James, and John in the wilderness between Harmony, Susquehanna County, and Colesville, Broome County. And again, the voice of God in the chamber of old Father Whitmer in Fayette, Seneca County, and at sundry times and in divers places through all the travels and tribulations of this Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Joseph Smith's litany of homely place names, his insistence that the voice of God could indeed be heard on the banks of an ordinary American river or in the chamber of a common farmer, gives his message an audacity and a power that cannot be ignored. That is, it is our very homeliness, our undivineness that is redeemed by that voice, that bit of leaven coming to us in those ordinary places. And for me, that witness that the divine can strike through the immediate is more important to me than any of the particulars in the church which Joseph Smith established. 2 or 3 years ago, I attended a small unofficial women's conference in Nauvoo, Illinois. The ostensible purpose was to celebrate the founding of the Relief Society, but the real agenda was to come to terms with the position of women in the church. For me, it was a very difficult meeting. It was a very down time for me intellectually in terms of my relationship with the church. I was concerned, and I think I literally emptied myself of any hope for change or peace in the church. But what happened, and it was a confirmation again to me, that admitting disbelief was a preparation for spiritual growth. I really felt that I heard the voice of the Lord on the banks of the Mississippi River. It was a voice of gladness, telling me that, yes, the gospel had been restored. It was a voice of truth, assuring me that my concerns were just and that my anguish was righteous. It was a voice of mercy, giving me the courage to continue my uneasy dialogue between doubt and faith. I'm not talking here about a literal voice, but I am talking about an infusion of the Spirit, a kind of Pentecost that for me dissolved the boundaries between present and past so that I felt I was re-experiencing the restoration that had taken place so many years before on the banks of that river. I am not a mystical person. I tend to be skeptical of spiritual experiences. In fact, in my own family, I'm more likely to call for a vote than a prayer. But I would gladly sift through a great pile of meal for even a little bit of that leaven.
Bill Barlow leaned over and asked me and told me he was going to let you take a short stretch, and I said, let me let them make a short stretch so that they'll think I'm a good guy. So you have 30 seconds. In the meantime, I'm wondering if one of the doorkeepers would be willing to bring Rex Lee and I a drink of water.
Make that three.
Four? I assure you that I feel a little sorry now that I spent the afternoon cutting all the jokes out of my talk so I could get down to something meaningful. I assure you that I've also spent the last few minutes cutting more pages out of it so that I could give Rex the time he deserves. But I'm really happy to be here. It's not my purpose this evening to tell you the details of my personal faith or even how that faith became part of me. Rather, I'd like to comment on certain attitudes toward faith, which are really among the most important pillars of my faith, and what they have meant to me over the years in my role as a professor at a church-sponsored institution of higher learning. Years ago, I read an address on sectarian education given by a sociologist who had been a minister in a Brethren church. He said at least two things that impressed me, for they applied, I thought, to Mormon education also. First, he pleaded for Brethren educators to be what he called avowedly sectarian. Otherwise, he asked, why Brethren education at all? I am convinced that deep in our particular heritage, he said, there are particularistic values which are of transcendent importance to our whole society. He then called for the type of education that gave Brethren youth and all youth a pride in their own special heritage and a sense of historical community. Somehow, all the factors that had gone into making me whatever I was cried out with empathy. Why a BYU at all? If not at least partly for the avowed purpose of giving its students certain values that, as a member of the church, I believe are of transcendent importance to our whole society. And how better to accomplish this than by trying to give them pride in their own special historical heritage? But this minister was not calling for education in the form of indoctrination, or for putting out in class the kind of propaganda that allows for no problems and for no independent, tough-minded thinking and evaluation on the part of students. Rather, He felt that students could become responsible citizens both in their church and in the world only by learning to face all problems, intellectual and otherwise, head on, and that ultimately their brethren values would win out in the conflict with worldly values simply because they were correct. As a brethren educator, conscious of my roots, he said, it would therefore be my purpose to develop tough-minded students, men and women who are conscious that they are destined to be at tension with the world. He then decried what he considered a tragic development in American education. We have come to think of the educator as an apologist for society as it is, foreman in an ideological factory concerned with the adjustment of the bright, questioning student to the status quo. I do not think, he added, that a good teacher is a claims adjuster for any system. Rather, a good teacher is a questioner, a man of both thought, passion, an agitator, and on the highest level of all, he may be a disturbing prophet. Well, such talk both discomforted and excited me. I felt that, and still feel, a personal obligation to help my students find good, sufficient reasons for faith in the fundamental principles of my church. But the man still had a point worth considering, and that concerned the difference between a claims adjuster and a teacher. I must be careful, I realize, not to drag young, tender-minded students into the world of challenges, ambivalence, and new ideas faster than they could manage. Nevertheless, if I am to assist in the process of true education, I must help get them into that world as soon as possible, and I must not leave them dependent just on me and my ideas for the support of their faith. Such a habit of dependence could well leave them equally dependent later upon ideas and information fed to them by someone with quite different perspectives. Hopefully, their university education will help them learn how, independently, to bring a variety of experiences to bear as their constantly changing world presents new challenges, new tensions, and new opportunities to broaden the horizons of their faith, even while deepening their commitment to the fundamentals. Well, if anyone can go from heaven to hell and back again in 2 minutes or less, I did it one day in the mid-1960s during a surprising conversation with a former student. That conversation so affected me and its implications that I've never forgotten it. Brother Allen, I can still hear her say, I want you to know that in your church history class, you pulled the rug right out from under my testimony. But you replaced it with pillars that can never be shaken. Well, at first I was stunned, and for a moment my mind couldn't get past the first half of her statement. What had I done or said? How could I possibly have pulled the rug from under anyone's faith in the church that I had worked so hard all my life to support and sustain and bear witness of? I dimly heard myself asking the student what she meant, but as she began to answer, I still worried. Did the rug pulling take place all at once and for a time leave a void of doubt? Or had the pulling out and the replacement process proceeded somewhat smoothly and simultaneously? I desperately hoped so, as my mind gradually tuned in again to what my student was saying. I'm not sure she had the rug very well defined in her mind, but I sensed that it consisted of at least two things. One, a lack of knowledge, and second, a tendency to place more faith in individuals than in what we in the church call the testimony of the Spirit. The pillars, on the other hand, were certain intellectual and spiritual tools that I hoped I could help all my students acquire and learn how to use. Most of these tools were attitudinal in nature. One, for example, was simply the love of knowledge, the thirst for information and understanding that comes as one begins to live the life of the mind and feel the profound pleasure of having a whole new world open up through the process of thoughtful reading and inquiry, especially in the field of history. Another tool, however, was the realization that the knowledge of historical facts is not necessarily synonymous with knowledge of truth. Contrary to popular myth, facts seldom, if ever, speak for themselves. Rather, historians and other scholars constantly sort, analyze, and interpret facts, both old and newly discovered, in an effort to get closer to historical truth. And my student had begun to understand that all history, including church history, is interpretive in nature and that no historian's interpretation of the facts is beyond challenge. Another of her new tools was a mature awareness that people will be disappointed if they expect perfection, even among the saints of God, and that one's faith in the church should not be built upon the arm of flesh or the assumption that any person, even a prophet, is above human imperfections. The many times Joseph Smith was called into account for his own mistake soon convinced my students of that. A fourth pillar for my young student's slowly maturing faith was an increasing confidence in her own ability to use the power of reason in separating truth from folly and discovering for herself patterns and principles that would help her make sense from her growing world of both religious and secular knowledge. As the hymnist once wrote, freedom and reason make us men, Take these away, what are we then? Mere animals. And just as well, the beasts may think of heaven or hell. Too often, my student had discovered, people appear to want their faith handed to them by others. They seem afraid to use that wonderful God-given power of reason that separates humans from animals and is fundamental to our belief that individual salvation is really dependent upon how effectively one exercises his or her free agency. I sometimes remind my students of what Elder J. Golden Kimball once said in conference. Some people fancy that we have a I won't try to imitate him. Some people fancy that we have the presidency and apostles of the church that will do our thinking for us. There are men and women so mentally lazy that they hardly think for themselves. To think calls for effort, which makes some men tired and wearies their souls. Latter-day Saints, you must think for yourselves. No man or woman can remain in this church on borrowed light. Well, closely connected with this was another pillar. The ability to realize that we will never, at least in this life, have all the answers either to the mysteries of the universe or the mysteries of godliness. If one's faith is based on the assumption that the gospel automatically answers all our questions, then indeed it is based on a rug that will help, that will slip and slide with almost every new vibration. In the world of secular knowledge, some degree of uncertainty is considered necessary to the advance of learning itself. I am not saying, of course, that our intellectual life should be one of total ambivalence, far from it. But we must learn to live with at least some ambivalence. For that, it seems to me, only opens the door to the kind of continuing inquiry necessary to the discovery of truth, as well as to the development of the life of the mind. And at least for me, it makes life exciting. In our religious world, there are many certainties, but there is much left to be discovered and revealed. And I try to teach my LDS students and that we should be excited with the possibility of helping to discover it. I also try to teach my students that if indeed they succeed in their eager quest for new information, knowledge, ideas, and insights, that they must also equip themselves with two more pillars that, at least in my mind, are essential to building an acceptable house of faith: humility in what one knows and charity toward those with whom one may disagree. In essentials, let there be unity. In non-essentials, liberty. And in all things, charity, Elder B.H. Roberts once emphasized during a general conference. How like the spirit of Joseph Smith, who said of Pelletiah Brown, "I did not like the being called up for erring in doctrine. It looks too much like the Methodists and not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. It does not prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine." In addition to all this, I tried to teach students in that girl's class that once they gain enough knowledge to make authoritative statements about some topics, they should never let anyone, including themselves, assume that they can make equally authoritative statements about others. I remember Henry Eyring mentioned an experience with Albert Einstein during World War II. The two of them had been working all morning in a physics lab, and when they went out to lunch, they happened to pass one of the victory gardens that were planted everywhere during the war. Eyring observed a bean patch and innocently asked Einstein what kind of beans they were. "I don't know," replied the greatest scientist on Earth. And in retelling the story, Henry Eyring simply remarked, "You see, Einstein didn't know beans." The point, of course, is that I may know a lot about a few things, and I can make some fairly authoritative statements on them, but this gives me no right to dogmatize on matters about which I know little or nothing. Certainly there are many areas in which I don't know beans, and I hope my students realize that. "I don't know" is a better answer than giving information that a student may later find to be untrue. If I do know something, however, it's better not to hedge or hide it, even if it seems troublesome, once the student begins to probe. At the same time, I should explain how I have gone about separating fact and fancy from fancy in my own life and essentials from non-essentials, and I must encourage students to learn all they can about the subjects of their interest, not being fearful of whatever truth they find. I should also teach them about the possibilities of misleading through a historical interpretation. Hopefully, all this will help them see reason for sometimes suspending judgment, for not jumping to conclusions whenever a new piece of information pops to the surface of their intellectual milieu. If students respect me as a scholar and are convinced I am not trying to hide anything from them, then they will also respect my integrity as a person. This means that when I tell them of my faith, they must respect that too. Hopefully, they also know that the fundamentals I believe in include, but are not limited to, the reality of God, the atonement and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the literal reality of Joseph Smith's first visions, or of all of Joseph Smith's visions, the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, the restoration of the gospel of Christ through Joseph Smith, and the importance and validity of temple work. These and other doctrinal things are as real to me as anything I may have learned in the secular world, and I try to share with my students the fact that I can no more ignore such realities in my ongoing search for truth than I can ignore the physical artifacts that may be discovered through traditional scholarly investigations. Finally, and most important, the young lady who talked with me that day was beginning more fully to realize that while all these attitudes were important to a mature faith, even more important was the testimony of the Spirit. If you want to know whether Joseph Smith's testimony is true, I often say to students, then you must have the same experience he had, and you can. Well, they know, of course, I'm not implying that they will see visions or heavenly beings. Rather, I am telling them that the truth of the essential foundations of the faith can be known to them only by the same process Joseph Smith went through. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, Joseph Smith read as a young man, and when he acted on that challenge, in faith, nothing wavering, he received his answer. All the intellectual and attitudinal pillars were clearly essential, but this one was central to the structure of the house of faith I was trying to help my students build. That conversation took place more than 20 years ago, and I was finally satisfied that, at least for this girl, the pillars had been erected before the rug was gone. Nevertheless, the memory of that conversation frequently has made me pause and ask myself, what am I really doing at BYU? Before coming to the university, I had spent several years teaching in the seminary and institute programs of the church. I knew well the intellectual problems often confronted by college students as the world of secular learning literally opened the skies with torrents of new ideas and information. Frequently, their newly sharpened intellectual skills led them to see things they had never seen before and find implications they had never found before in both the history and the teachings of the church. At times, they also discovered new information about the past that seemed to fly in the face of something they had been taught as youngsters, some weakness or mistake, some heretofore unknown conflict, a change in some church practice, or a modification in some church teaching. Some who came with troubled questions seemed to want me to tell them that such bothersome things simply hadn't happened. Instead, I tried to help them understand how both the human and divine could operate within the church and why they should not be surprised to see evidence of both in their study of church history, non-essentials, and some deeper insight in how to gain the testimony of the Spirit. No longer, I told them, could they rely on someone else's testimony. It was do-it-yourself time. I realized that the most important people at any university are the students. I began to judge myself in part on the basis of what I thought I was doing for students and what effect anything I said or wrote might have on them. This, it seemed to me, was my highest academic calling. What this meant for my career was a commitment to students that included opening my door to them, inviting them to my home, and dealing with them as important people rather than as bothersome incidentals to the university atmosphere. This, it seemed to me, was a mission that, in a sense, I had called myself to simply by my decision to make a career in the academic world. An essential element in that career was my continuing work in rug replacement. And my most haunting question is still whether or not I have done it well. Whether I was teaching religion or history didn't matter. Students often sought me out wanting to discuss the complicated problems of church history. At the same time, I was something more, I hoped, than a teacher whose influence would be felt only in the classroom or in the office. I was a professor, professing to be a historian in front of both undergraduate and graduate students. How could I teach them what that meant unless I set some kind of example? Obviously, this meant research, writing, and publishing, and I made up my mind that part of my responsibility was to do just that. History, then, to me, is more than what one person called a bag of tricks played on the deck. Among other things, it should help students understand themselves a little better by seeing many of the forces affecting their lives in broader perspective. Wisdom is the principal thing, said Solomon. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. I want my students to get understanding, to be excited about new ideas about the past, and to learn from it in many ways that will make their lives richer. My publications that I hoped they would read included Western, urban, economic, and political history, but concentrated most heavily on Mormon history. Not everything, of course, is geared to teach some great eternal principle. Some of it is purely academic and dull.
designed to argue a point or simply add to the available knowledge of some movement or development. I should admit that. Much, however, was deliberately crafted with students in mind, intentionally designed to help them find their way through very current issues. I believe that issue-oriented writing, in which certain principles and/or patterns are illustrated or clarified, can help readers develop their own intellectual tools, and in turn, make the next problem that much easier to solve for themselves. Then the sentence says, use the material in this section only if time is okay. So we'll move on to the next. I have time only for one example of an article that grew directly out of the needs of many students. In this case, I deliberately used a historical event to help students work through their own contemporary problems related to the church. I had been studying the debates in Utah in 1919 over whether or not the United States should join the League of Nations. At the same time, I seemed to be inundated by students who were concerned with certain intense political controversies within the church. This was in the 1960s, and particularly with the fact that even some church leaders seemed to disagree on political matters. Some of these students seemed to assume that there should be some final authoritative church position, even on the political issues of the day. Perhaps ironically, I had discovered that back in 1919, there were not only differences among church leaders on the League of Nations, but that they did not hesitate to make their differences known publicly. Even the president of the church, Heber J. Grant, made a public statement supporting the League, but in doing so, he made it clear that this was nothing more than a personal opinion, and he would never use the authority of the scriptures or his position in the church to impose that view on others. In short, it seemed to me, what happened in 1919 wonderfully demonstrated the fact that one's testimony of the gospel should never compel a person to take particular political positions. What a golden opportunity, I thought, to use the events of the past to help students wrestle with their own problems of the present. Here was the way to build a pillar. So I wrote a speech, presented it before the Mormon History Association, and was able to get it published where it could become readily available to students and colleagues alike. I didn't mention contemporary political problems, but discussed in detail what happened in 1919 and tried to draw important inferences from it. Differences of opinion are to be expected, I tried to show, but the important thing is to avoid bitterness in debate and accusations of lack of faith, something that had occurred, unfortunately, among certain unthinking members of the church in 1919, and something that President Grant decried. As he talked to the church about the controversy, in fact, he quoted something that President John Taylor had said to him when he was a young apostle. My boy, never forget that when you are in the line of your duty, your heart will be full of love and forgiveness. You can know the difference between the spirit of the Lord and the spirit of the adversary when you find that you are happy and contented, that you love your fellows, that you are anxious for their welfare, and you can tell that you do not have the spirit when you are full of animosity and feel you would like to mow somebody down. And so the church went on, I began my concluding paragraph, and what followed was really my personal message to my students. Perhaps at no time in its history, I'm quoting, had there been such divergence of opinion among its leaders, but it seemed to have little effect upon their working together in harmony to build the kingdom. Does this answer the question as to whether they should have been unified? Perhaps not. But at least it demonstrates that in this instance, those who really wanted to follow the example of their leaders would not avoid debate or expression of personal opinion, but would refuse to let that opinion stand in the way of goodwill based on genuine respect for the right and responsibility of each man to think for himself on such issues. In this case, there is a moral in history. There have been other such articles over the years in both church and scholarly journals deliberately designed with my students in mind. Frequently then, I think back on that early unsettling conversation about rugs and pillars, and on my determination to set the example for students in the integrity of both my scholarship and my faith. I'm sure I have not had a perfect record, but my blessing is that I can continue to try, then try some more, and then try and try again. For some reason, I keep finding rugs that need replacing, and I sincerely pray that my ongoing efforts to exercise both responsible scholarship and abiding faith will continue to provide some pillars with which to replace them. Thank you.
Brothers and sisters, this for me has been a fulfilling and enriching evening, and I'm pleased to have been here and honored to be a participant. Can you hear me in the back? You cannot?
Yes.
If you can't, there are some people up here in the front who can, who'd like to trade places with you. The topic of our discussion this evening, which has been so brilliantly treated by my four colleagues, is Pillars of My Faith. I'd like to take two key words in that title and treat each of them in inverse order and very briefly. First, I'd like to talk just briefly about my faith and then about its pillars. I'm absolutely convinced that in 1820 or thereabouts, Joseph Smith really saw the Father and the Son. And that the experiences that that ushered in, including those from about 1825 to 1830, really occurred. That on the banks of the Susquehanna River, the same man who baptized the Savior of the world actually came here to this earth and conferred the Aaronic priesthood on Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. Now that is something that you just can't take lightly. Because if it really happened, as I testify to you that I'm absolutely convinced it did, then there's some very important things that follow from it. One is that it means that we're not in this alone, that it's not simply a matter of pursuing our own ideas, our own religious convictions on our own, that each of us does depend on the other, and even more important, or at least equally as important, that we depend on each other in part, because there needs to be, there is a role for the priesthood. That the matter of certain saving ordinances does enter into the overall picture. Otherwise, why the restoration? Predicted as long as ago as the day of Pentecost in the third chapter of Acts. That is my faith. Now, what are its pillars? I've reflected on this question. What if you were to ask my friends, my non-Mormon friends, particularly those that I've known as I've lived in Washington over the past 5 years, what are the pillars of this man's faith? Why does he believe as he does? I'm not sure, but I think the answer for most of them would probably be a variant of the following. The way he lives and the things that he does are different in some respects from most people. Many of those differences are keyed to his belief. He does them differently because he's Mormon. I think he likes those differences, and that's why he believes the way that he does. And that answer just rubs up against the truth. And yet in another issue, in another sense, it's very misleading. Let me tell you first in which sense it is correct. It is true that because I'm a Mormon, I do some things differently than I would if I were a Presbyterian, a Muslim, or an atheist. And I am pleased with those differences. Let me give you a couple of examples. This first one that I've selected, I selected not knowing that those who put this program together would bring a ringer, Carlford Broderick, in on me, who could dispute this as a matter of fact. So out of decency, since I didn't say anything unkind about your speech, I would appreciate if you don't... I think that statistically I'm a better divorce risk because I'm a Mormon. That there is a statistical probability of divorce in the case of a Mormon who's been married in the temple is less than in the case of the community as a whole. Now, whether that's true or not, I think that there is a good reason that it ought to be true. And it's something that reaches beyond just divorce statistics. My marriage and the family that is produced have eternal significance. I'm absolutely convinced of that. It's tied up in the same package as what I testified to you a moment or two ago. And that gives an extra dimension to my life and to my family life, to the way I look at my wife, the way I look at my children, the kinds of things that we do within our family. And because of those things, my life is happier. And has an extra dimension to it, and I like that. The second example, I am a participant, is in what is probably the world's best welfare program. It is not a good welfare program. There are no good welfare programs in the world. Any welfare program is beset with enormous practical administrative difficulties. But I think this is probably about as good as you're going to get. And I'm a beneficiary in that. The reason that it's about as good as any that you're going to get is it is run by people and for people who share a common spiritual bond and who see other people's physical and temporal needs as part of their broader spiritual needs. And a closely related point is that much, not all, but much of my social life is connected with people who believe as I do. There is a third example. I don't smoke and I don't drink. I am absolutely convinced that the reason I do neither is because my behavior is motivated by my belief. Knowing myself, where I grew up, when I grew up, and the environment in which I grew up, I would if I were not a member of this church, and if I did not believe as I do, and I would not be as well off as I am. There are other things, family home evening program, religious instruction program for my children on Sundays, opportunity to for 2 years of voluntary service, which in my case have given me benefits far beyond just from the standpoint of my selfish professional advancement, far beyond any other two-year investment that I've made. All of these and more are contributing to make my life simply happier and more fulfilling. Is this then a pillar of my faith? Is this why I believe? My answer is no. Those are welcome consequences and not unimportant ones of my belief, but they are not the reason for it. Indeed, they have nothing to do with it. So if the reasons are not practical, result-oriented, then are they rational? Are they objective? Do they come about as a result of thought processes? And a decent case can be made for the proposition that they should be. I'm very impressed by the profundity of some of the latter-day doctrines, some of the principles that we have as a result of modern-day revelation. I'll give you just two examples. One of them was mentioned by Phil Barlow, Moses 1 and 39. I just think there is enormous, enormous intellectual content in that statement by the Lord concerning what is his work and his glory. Now, there's been, I think the theme of every member of this panel, highlighted probably mostly by Carlfred Broderick, the admonition in the Doctrine comes in the 93rd section, 36th verse, to acquire knowledge, understanding by study and also by faith. There are many people in the world today who are quite skilled at acquiring knowledge, understanding, insights through the intellectual, the rational processes. There are other people who are quite able at acquiring knowledge, understanding through extra-rational processes. The most wise, the people who really have complete understanding, are those who see those two processes not as mutually antithetical, not as the natural enemies of each other, but as side-by-side processes. And I'll get in just a moment and in conclusion to what you do on those, on the rare occasion where you do find some inconsistency between the two. Finally, just as an intellectual matter, at least the final thing that I'll mention, that really appeals to me as a rational, objective, intellectual matter, is the bare existence of the Book of Mormon. I'm a lawyer. One of the most persuasive things that you can say about any proposition as a legal matter is that it has withstood the test of time. The Book of Mormon has withstood the test of time. It's been with us for 156 years. Over that period of time, it has been beset by many propositions, many suggestions as to where it really came from. One by one, each of those has fallen by the wayside. And the only decent explanation that I can come to, even aside from what I'm going to tell you in a few moments about what I feel about the Book of Mormon, is that there's simply no other explanation other than the one that it came about exactly the way that Joseph Smith said that it did. And along the way, there have been a number of rather interesting pieces of information that have come to light concerning things about the Egyptian language, things about names that appear in the Book of Mormon, some archaeological discoveries, most notably about horses that people didn't think existed, that tend to bear out that there is no way that a young 23-year-old or anyone else in the early 19th century could possibly have known about. I'm in a profession whose basic approach is objective and analytical. Is the existence of this body of objective evidence, then, the reason that I believe? Is this the pillar of my faith? And the answer is certainly not. I pay some attention to it because I find it interesting. But I'm not even a serious student of it. That is, this archaeological evidence or the debate among the scholars as to the word prints, the kind of things about tracing through Egyptian names and Egyptian phrases. I know very little about chiasmus, though I certainly respect those who do, and I commend them on their pursuit of it as an intellectual matter. But I wouldn't care if tomorrow there were a unanimous declaration by every archaeologist in America that there was not and could not have been any such thing as a pre-Columbian horse. That would not affect my belief one iota. Having now cataloged the reasons that I do not believe, or that do not constitute the reason that I believe, let me tell you very simply why I do. And let me give you, this particular experience does not constitute the sum and substance. It is merely one experience that occurred to me at a crucial point in my life, and represented not the sum and substance, not even the culmination, but a representative experience. It happened in the fall of 1955 and the winter of 1956, when I was a new missionary in Mexico. And I had grown up in the church, a very orthodox kind of upbringing, and had periodically borne my testimony. And I became a missionary and began to preach the gospel, and as an integral part of what I was doing, I would bear my testimony that I knew that the things we were telling was true. That began to bother me. And for the first time in my life, I began to ask myself, can I really say that? And it was one of the genuine intellectual crises in my life. I didn't stop doing what I was doing, but mindful of the admonition in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 10 of the Book of Moroni, and accomplishing it against the background of that admonition, I began to read the Book of Mormon another time and to put the Lord to that test like I simply hadn't done any prior occasion. That had been going on for about a month. The next thing that I'm going to tell you happened one afternoon, and I can still take you, though it was 30 years ago, the exact street and show you exactly where it happened, and it will sound to you like a very ordinary kind of event. It was profound to me, and I don't know whether I can recreate it for you or not. It was in the days when the missionary lessons consist of 7 parts, and we attracted out a widow lady and her 2 daughters. And the first 2 lessons had been singularly unimpressive. Frankly, I was surprised that we even got back in the third time. But the third lesson in that old series was simply a story of the Restoration, and it was simply testimony bearing. It would simply tell what happened in the course of the Restoration. We would trade back between us, and one would tell one aspect in Barry's testimony, and then the other would go on to something else. And it came my turn to tell the story of the Restoration of the Aaronic Priesthood. As I began to tell that, there was a thought that came to me, and it just consumed my whole soul. And the thought was this: that really happened. The same man who baptized the Savior of the world actually came here to this earth. He personally was here
And he laid his hands on the head of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery and said, "Upon you, my fellow servants, I confer the priesthood of Aaron." He did it. And while I was talking, and as that was occurring to me, I saw something happen that I had read about and that Nephi talks about in the first verse of his great valedictory address, the 33rd chapter of 2 Nephi. When someone speaks with the power of the Holy Ghost, the whole power of the Holy Ghost will carry the truth of that to the people who are living. I saw it happen. I will tell you, brothers and sisters, conversion occurred that afternoon. And I knew it happened. I didn't need to ask. I knew that they knew, just as I had known. And I finished, and I just said, "This man has brought back the power to baptize. When do you want to be baptized?" And the answer was, "Cuando ustedes digan," whenever it's convenient for you. I thought parenthetically, now I've really found out how to be a missionary. And I'll just do that for the rest of my 2 years here, and I'll convert the whole Mexican Republic. I never was able quite completely to read. It made me a more effective missionary, and I really was from that point forward. I never was really able completely to recreate that particular circumstance. But I did see that woman become the Relief Society president and both those young daughters go on missions. Well, now the final point that I want to make is, and Broderick alluded to it when he said he got to the point where this nudist friend of his came to him and asked him, now what do I do? And I hope you notice very carefully the two options that he gave him, and he said he couldn't think of a third. And I said to myself at that point, there's a man after my own heart. Because there will come times, not often, do these two mandated means of gaining knowledge, the rational and the extra-rational, lead to opposite results. But sometimes they will. Sometimes they will. And the final thought that I'd like to leave with you is, what do you do in those rare circumstances where it happens? Well, now, let me tell you first what you don't do, two things that you don't do. One is, you don't quit using the rational process. You don't quit thinking about it. And the second is, you don't say, because I can't understand it, I will reject the extra rational process. The attitude that I think you do adopt is this. You say, I understand that one of the purposes of this life is as a testing and a growing process, and it is necessary to that testing process that we use both our intellectual processes, both our intellectual capacities, and also our extra-rational processes, and that it's just inevitable that sometimes there are going to be some inconsistencies, they're going to lead to different results. When that happens, my job is simply to continue to struggle with it. But over a period, until I can work it out rationally, I have to assume that the more reliable is the extra rational. Now let me give you one final example, and then I'm through, that just bears that out. When I grew up on sawmills in eastern Arizona and western New Mexico, sawmill camps. We would spend every summer in a sawmill camp. It's a way of life that doesn't exist anymore. With the advent of electricity in that part of the country, it simply is no longer feasible to operate the sawmill camp. But we had, in this one camp, we finally progressed to the point where we bought a light plant. It would generate electricity, and we would turn it on from 6 until 10 every night, and that's when people would iron their clothes, and they could read by an electric light instead of a coal oil lamp. And that was a great advantage over what we'd had before. But every night at 10 o'clock, it was my job to go turn out the light plant. And I would do it, and that great big old Buddha motor, and I would turn on, and the noise would stop. You'd hear a couple of barking dogs somewhere in the camp, relieved that that noise was finally off. There was not a single light anywhere, and there was not a sound anywhere, because those were people that got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and by that time, they were ready for bed. It was also an area of the country where the air was of pristine purity. And I remember my walks back to the house after turning out the light plant, deathly silent, and the stars just shining like brilliant crystals. And I remember looking out there and remembering what my high school science teachers had told me about the numbers of light years that they were there, that they were out there. And saying to myself, how far is it really? And then eventually the question, and what's beyond? What's beyond? Now, I knew from my study of the scriptures that nothing's beyond. I mean, it just keeps going. It goes on and on and on, and there is no end. And I can't deal with that, brothers and sisters. My mind is not capable of dealing with a universe that has no end. I guess it's really not capable of dealing with many things that have no end, except this speech, which is coming very, very soon. But I could not then, and I cannot then, and I cannot now comprehend that you can just keep going and going and going, and you never come to an end. I knew it was true. I accepted it was true, because that's what the scriptures tell me, but I could not then, and I cannot now understand it. But my mind is good enough to know this, that the alternative is, if there is an end out there, what's on the other side? And then what happens? Do you come to, well, I. That's one area. That's one area where I simply have to say to myself, this brain up here, as good as it is, and even as good as Jim Allen's is, and his better than mine, that's one example of the kind of things we simply can't comprehend. And that's enough of an example to tell me that there are other things that I can't comprehend, and when they do come into conflict, there is no question in my mind which it is that must prevail. Thank you very much.
I'm going to be very aggressive and be very quick and first. Brother Brad, have your views on sexual education changed?
My views on sexual education I haven't even told you, except that I'm in favor of it. But what I have come to believe is that the brethren were absolutely right in that I never anticipated that sex education would be taking place in a moral vacuum. In the early 60s, that didn't seem very likely, and I feel that the brethren anticipated what has in fact happened, that sex and sexual matters have been taught with the premise that there are no values to be associated with it. And that was what the brethren objected to when we talked about it, was that we were teaching it in a value-free context, we were teaching it informationally, with the unspoken message that no values need apply, and that was contrary to the gospel. And I now honor the brethren for seeing what I was too involved to see at the time.
We don't have too much time for questions. If there are any, step to one of the mics, and if not, we'll pray.
Go.
We're all convinced. We again would like to thank our panelists. As I mentioned at the first of our program, some of them have been very generous with their time in coming a long distance, and we're grateful for that. Sister Christine Durham will dismiss us with a benediction.
Our Father, we have been graced this evening with messages from persons whose souls are generous and whose hearts have been sufficiently filled with familiarity of the things of the Spirit to share them with us. We are grateful for that opportunity and we are grateful for their generosity. We are mindful of our own responsibilities to seek out paths that they have trod and to have the courage to follow those paths ourselves in our own searches for wisdom and for faith. Please grant us thy grace in those journeys and thy comfort in the times which are difficult for us. We pray for these things in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.